Welcome to another episode of Story Secrets. And the moment is finally here. After watching and analyzing the series Neon Genesis Evangelion for several months now, I have finally watched the ending of the story, or maybe I should say endings. In this episode, I give you my first impressions of episodes 25, 26, and of the movie The End of Evangelion. I'm your host, Father Roderick. I'm a priest, I'm a geek, and I love to share with you the secrets of the stories that you like. It's good to be back here, and I love to continue talking about my favorite anime series of all times. Not that I've watched any other anime. I am currently sampling a few other series, but this was my first anime, and it is definitely ranking among the best stories in general, not just in the world of anime, but in general that I've ever seen. What I love about Neon Genesis Evangelion is the depth, the multi-layeredness of it, and, most importantly, of the openness of the story to multiple interpretations. Ever since the series came out in 1995, fans have been debating the meaning, or the meanings, the various secrets that were hidden by the creators in the story. And there is no end to that, and that is on purpose. Hideaki Anno has said that he hopes that people will continue to add their layers of interpretation to the story that he created. And he's been very coy himself when it comes to explaining his series. Some other people that were working on the project have come out and said to the press, well, hey, you know what, about those religious Christian or biblical symbols, yeah, that's just because we were looking for something exotic. We're from a Japanese background, and so we figured this could be something that our core audience is not familiar with, so it looks cool, and that's why. But Hideaki Anno has said, yeah, that's true. We none of us who worked on the series have a Christian background, so it is definitely exotic, but I'm not going to tell you what it all means, and my take on this whole thing is that there's actually much more rhyme and reason to the choice of these symbols, names, and events that we see in the series than meets the eye. And what I've tried to do on TikTok is showing that by giving little nuggets, little pieces of information, a bit of background. Where do these symbols come from? What do they mean in the Bible, for instance, or in Hebrew scripture and in rabbinic tradition? There are many different backgrounds linked to the various symbols, so it's not just Christian symbolism. But I try to explain a little bit more what the background is of that symbolism, and then what I try to do is to bring it back to the story. Because it's not my purpose to demonstrate that this is a Christian story or that this is a series that wants to tell a religious tale. Absolutely not. That would also be counter to the intentions of the makers. But what I do believe is that the message of the story has definitely a lot of parallels with messages in the great religions. Because these are the most fundamental questions that we all ask ourselves from time to time. You know, why am I here? What is my role? How do I deal with violence, with abuse, with trauma? Who am I? Who am I supposed to be? And so what I try to do is to show that by uncovering the deeper meaning of the symbolism that was used in this series, you will actually understand the message better. Or you'll be able to see things that you weren't able to see if you just look at the story as such and by saying, hey, well, you know what, the religious imagery, that is just to look cool. I think you're missing out on a lot of depth that I think is part of why this series has such a long-lasting appeal. So here's what I want to do. In this episode, I want to talk about my first impressions, and it's just first impressions. I'm not at the point yet where I would dare to give an analysis and an explanation of the finale of this story, but I want to tell you what my first thoughts are after having seen the two last episodes of the television series, and then also the two other episodes that were made a year later after the television series finale got a lot of backlash from the fans at the time. So they retold the story of what happens at the end of the Shinji's journey, you could say, but this time from another perspective and from a different angle, and also with changes. And it's fascinating to juxtapose these two, to compare them to one another. And it also had a huge impact on me because I was expecting certain things to happen. And I was at first utterly confused. And I have had a lot of emotions while watching both the ending of the television series and also the end of Evangelion. That's the name, the overall title for these two kind of remade episodes. And that kind of wraps up that first part of the story, because of course the manga continues the story, and there are also a few other made-for-TV movies that have come out afterwards, which I haven't seen yet, but I'll get to that at a later point. So that's what I want to do first, give you my overall sentiment and my first thoughts about the way this story ends and where everything that I've been studying for so many months actually led to. And then what I want to do next time is to go back and rewatch. Now that I know how the story is ending, I want to go back to the first episode and do a deep dive analysis of everything that I now can see in that first episode, and then the second and the third, we'll be busy for a while, that I missed because I didn't know where the story went. I didn't know the full background. This is one of those genius stories that it really pays off to go back after you've seen how it ends. It's kind of a little bit with, I'm a big Star Wars fan. With Star Wars as well, what they do now is to enhance the movies that we already know by telling the backstory. So we've seen the story of Obi-Wan Kenobi, and now that we know how he spent his time on Tatooine between the prequels and A New Hope, that when you now rewatch A New Hope, that character all of a sudden has way more depth, and some of the things that he says carry much more weight than they had when that backstory wasn't there. And so I love that when the story has so many layers, and so many layers are added to that story, that it makes you want to go back and reevaluate what you thought you knew. That, for me, is part of the attraction of Neon Evangelion, Neon Genesis Evangelion. So that's what we're going to do. And then every week when I do a deep dive per episode, I will also create a short TikTok video where I just take one highlight of that episode, or I will just probably repackage it or re-record it. But as you know, the TikToks are only a few minutes, you know, it's 2-3 minutes. What I do on TikTok is usually considered to be very long because it's a short attention span type of medium. But I hope that people are intrigued by what they see on TikTok so that they come over, and if they become a patron, they can also join you as an audience and listen to these shows. The first part of this episode is going to be still spoiler-free, and then I will give a clear spoiler warning, and then I'll just go in-depth and talk spoilers. So for those of you that haven't watched Neon Genesis Evangelion yet, or you've only seen part of the story, don't worry. The first part is still going to be for everyone, and then we'll just go and dive in. Let's listen to the audio of a trailer that was made in 1997 for the end of Evangelion.
For who would lose, though full of pain, this intellectual being, those thoughts that wander through eternity, to perish rather, swallowed up and lost, in the wide womb of uncreated night.
The fate of destruction is also the joy of rebirth.
The battle has been joined. With a host of Evas under their direct command, the military might of a Sella organization stands poised to wrest control of Nerve's greatest achievement, Eva Unit 1. It alone holds the key to humanity's final fate. But the ultimate choice to cast out the world we know rests with one young man. Beyond jealousy and betrayal, beyond hate and desire, beyond pain and death lies the ultimate revelation, the final choice, the end. Manga Entertainment presents the highly anticipated conclusion to the Neon Genesis Evangelion saga.
Mercy, we have begun Third Impact.
The end of Evangelion.
Big applause, supposedly coming from the fans. Definitely my applause, because I think this was quite the ending to the story. Now, I said that this was going to be spoiler-free, but I don't think I have to worry about any of you who haven't finished the series yet that you'd be spoiled by what I just played. Because to me, if you had shown me this a few weeks ago, I would have been like, okay, I have no idea what this is about. This is so confusing. What are they talking about? And that is because a lot of the elements that are just kind of briefly touched upon here in this trailer are explained in the very last moments of the series. It's only towards the end that a lot of stuff comes together. And even then, I was still scratching my head. It's like, wait, what did I just see? So let's start first with my general, again, spoiler-free idea or feelings about the way the television series ended. What I love about this story is that it is not just a story about, you know, huge mega robots fighting each other. What the creators wanted to do was to set it apart from series that do that, you know, are about these big mech robots fighting and battling each other. They wanted to give this story more of a soul, maybe even literally in a certain way. And that is why, from the beginning, we follow the pilots of those big, you know, robots or whatever creatures they are. And we get to know a little bit of their backstory. And the series constantly switches between the very mundane day-to-day life of these kids, because they're all like 13, 14 years old, trying to deal with school, with, you know, their burgeoning emotions and going through puberty and whatnot. So it, from on the one hand, this looks like a very kind of common Japanese slice of life type of anime. And then there are these big dramatic fighting scenes, this overall huge mythology that shows you little pieces of what's going on, but never reveals the full truth. And even at points during the story, tries to kind of make you think about things in a certain way, and only to completely turn that upside down later on when you realize what is truly going on. And this is not just true for us as an audience, but it's also true for a lot of the main characters who have actually no idea what they are involved in. And then there is a third layer. So you've got the slice of life stuff, you've got the big mythological apocalyptic battle going on, and then there is the inner journey. There is what connects these two stories is what happens on the inside of the main characters, and more particularly of Shinji, who is the main character. I wouldn't say the hero of the story, because he definitely is not a hero and doesn't see himself as a hero, but he's the protagonist. And because of this inner story, which also is about a battle, but it's not a battle with forces from the outside, it's a battle, an inside battle between the good and evil inside of every one of us, with trauma and hurt and fear and everything that holds us back, and then at the same time this longing for liberation, for healing, for, you know, something else. And because you have that external story of a battle and you've got that internal story, and it is at the same time about these regular kids that a lot of us can identify with, because we've all been, you know, at that age, 13, 14 years old. So we do recognize a lot of their emotions and the conflicts and the little things that make life very hard at that age. What I believe is so genius about this story is that ultimately the bigger story, the big outside external battle is, I think, a metaphor of the inner battle. And that brings me to the last two episodes of the television series and why they are so incredibly good. And I know that this is kind of a solitary position. Not many people actually liked the ending of the television series. Even the majority of the people that follow me on TikTok, and there are hundreds of thousands of them, most of them agree that the way the television show ends is rubbish. And if you really want to get a good experience of the ending of the story, you have to watch the end of Evangelion. I disagree. I really want to stress how much these last two episodes, first of all, follow from the entire story that came before it. And then secondly, are told in a way that is so creative and innovative and touch upon such deep layers that are so relatable that I actually believe that the way the television show ended is far superior to the way they wrap up the story in the end of Evangelion. It's for me, it's no doubt, no discussion possible. The television show ending is the ending that this story needed. And yes, the movie gives a lot of context and gives you a lot of, like, oh, so what was going on, what we didn't see in the television show, but it's only information. It doesn't, for me, it doesn't go to the core of what this story is about, which is this inner conflict. And so the last two episodes of the series are almost entirely taking place inside the minds of the main protagonists, especially Shinji, but also to a lesser extent Asuka and Rei. And it's very atypical. Now, one of the kind of pragmatic reasons for these final two episodes to be so different, also stylistically, is that they actually ran out of time and they ran out of resources. The whole series was made under extreme duress. It was very, very difficult to get these episodes done in time, especially getting the story started. Took months and months of preparation. I think the first episode, it took them 6 months to write it and to prepare for it. And so they were in a crunch time-wise. They also were in a crunch budget-wise. There was almost no money left. And this is still an anime from the time that everything was hand-drawn. And so, yes, of course, there are a few, I think, computer graphics involved. But still, every second that you see consists of 24 individual frames. You know, that's how animation works. Or in this case, in anime, oftentimes much less frames. And that's one of the ways that anime has such a distinct style. It's oftentimes because they use one cell, sometimes for several seconds, and they will just change move the background. But the rest of the image is static. That's why everything is so stylized, and oftentimes you're looking at a scene, for instance, when they go down to the city below the surface of Tokyo 3, and the only thing that moves is the background. It's the elevator, but the rest is static. It was just a very pragmatic way of saving money, because then you don't have to draw all these different, you know, cells. You can just use one drawing and then just have the background move. You just make a bigger background. So what was conceived as a way to cut the budget, it was something that made also in a certain way the look that we associate so much with anime. And the problem was that for the last two episodes of the television series, they were under contract. They didn't even have the money, the budget to do like super low level cell animation. So even with the tricks that they used in previous episodes, they weren't able to get to the end of the story. And so that's why they had to resort to even more mundane sources of imagery. And that's why in these two last episodes, you will also see real footage, like just stock footage from people, from trains, from whatever. And you see sketches, you see pencil sketches. They reuse almost everything that they created in the past, including their pencil sketches, to tell that story of what happens on the inside of Shinji's mind. So it's super abstract, and I can totally see why that is jarring to a lot of people. But what I think is so genius is that despite those constraints, despite that crunch, it still does something extraordinary, because the journey of Shinji, what he goes through, what he starts to realize over time, is so deep and so true. And the reason I think that it has such an emotional impact, at least on me, is that this is actually based on Hideaki Anno's own experiences. He has often said in interviews that he suffers from depression, and that before he started to make Neon Genesis Evangelion, he had a period of time, several years, where he was in a deep depression. And then someone gave him a book about psychology. I'm not exactly sure which book it was. But during his depression, he started to read that book. And to him, it was a revelation. That psychology book helped him to understand what was going on, why he was suffering from depression, what the choices were that he needed to make. And a lot of what you see in Shinji's character, and that also is sometimes grating and irritating, is like he's always crying, always whining, complaining, always blaming everyone around him, but he's afraid to look inside. So he is constantly on the run. He wants to hide between other people, and then when other people don't help him, he feels even more powerless. Very, very similar, I think, to what many people who suffer from depression also experience. It's this you're closed up from the world. It seems like you're completely isolated. No one can help you, and you can't help yourself. So there doesn't seem to be an exit. And having more insight in how your brain works, how your emotions are linked to neural pathways, and how trauma can make certain connections in your brain that are not healthy, but you keep repeating the patterns, and so that always kind of repeats and even strengthens the depressed feelings. Once you start to understand how that works, you can also maybe discover a way out. And that is what is happening in these last two episodes, where Shinji, who has gone through so much emotional trauma in his early years, he lost his mom, he has a horrible father, again, not spoiler, because it's in the first episode, his father is a horrible person. He every time that he fights these angels, these aggressive monsters, it's a reflection of what's happening inside of him. He feels like he's in a fight with forces that he can't understand, that seem to come back all the time, and there's no end to it. And if you've defeated one, then there is another one that pops up. Just like in depression, you may sometimes have that feeling that no matter what you do, no matter how much you try to resist, it comes back in waves, and then it takes you back into that darkness and into that solitude. And there seems to be no victory possible until you start to realize that you are the one that can make a change. That healing has to come from the inside. Yes, with maybe outside help and with people that explain to you, or a book, you know, that it can tell you this is how it works. You have to do the work. There's no one who can do it for you. You can't take a pill against depression. You can take medication to suppress the symptoms. But the origin of what causes this inner darkness, that is something, that's a fight you have to fight yourself. That, I think, and I'm not a psychologist, but this is what I gather from the story. This is what Hideaki Anno wanted to tell. It's about his own battle and his own efforts to overcome this isolation by opening up to the people and by accepting that life is fundamentally broken. That it's not, you know, it's no use to run away from pain and suffering like we all do, but people that suffer from depression do it maybe to the extreme. But that the only way to get out of that darkness is to accept that even though you may step into the light, it's not going to be like heaven. There's still going to be pain and violence and suffering. But you have to grow stronger. You have to make the deliberate decision that you want to live and that you are worth living. And that despite suffering, you still have value. And so that's a journey that I think is explained very well in these last two episodes. And for me, that was the core of the story. So I was so fascinated that they dared to tell that part of the story and forego the whole, you know, bigger mythology. Which brings me to the end of Evangelion, which is the movie, where in these two more cinematic versions of this ending, they show what happened at the same time in the outside world. And so, yeah, that's fascinating. That's really riveting. And it's also very shocking, because that battle also culminates in a lot of violence. And there were times there I was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe they put this in the movie. There is this infamous scene in the hospital that a lot of people on TikTok wanted me to comment upon. And that's just part of the tragic decisions that Shinji takes over and over again. And it's just minor tragedy compared to the mass murder that takes place in that final episode. It's really gruesome. I want to warn you that this is unlike anything you've seen in the television series. And yet, it's kind of the logical conclusion of that story. It is an apocalyptic battle. But what is the big shocker of the end of Evangelion is not the scope of that final battle, but it is that in that movie, Shinji takes different decisions. Instead of healing, he is actually getting worse. And so it's almost like a mirror image of the end of the television series. It's like the, you know, that in Stranger Things, you've got the regular world, and then you've got the, you know, how do they call it, the underworld, or the upside down. And this is what gave me such a whiplash when watching the end of Evangelion. I was like, but where is the story that they were telling in the last two television episodes? This is the opposite. And it's only after seeing the whole thing that I started to wonder, well, maybe that's on purpose as well. Maybe that is what they wanted to do, to tell two possible endings, which then makes the end of Evangelion very intriguing and definitely worth re-exploring. But, and I'm going to wrap things up and then I'm going into spoiler territory, but my final thoughts about the end of Evangelion is that it baffled me. I was watching, and again, I've studied this series. I thought I knew what was going on. And then I'm just, there were so many moments during that movie that I was like, what is happening? What am I watching? There are like minute-long sequences where I'm completely out of any clue as to why that is included. There are hints that there is a rhyme and reason to all that. But at the same time, it goes so fast and there's so much happening that I just don't have the time to think about it. And so at the end of that movie, I was exhausted. I was emotionally, intellectually, completely exhausted. I was like, oh my goodness, I have to rewatch this multiple times, and I probably will have to do a lot of research in order to fully understand why they told the story this way and why this story, this version of the story, is so different and in many ways opposite to what they showed at the end of the television series. So I had so many emotions. There was also a lot of tragedy in the end of Evangelion. There are moments where you're like, oh, no, they didn't do really. there were just times that where I was just, man, don't tell this. I don't want to see this story. It's too emotional. It's too hard. It's too painful. And you know what? That's probably, again, on purpose. They want us to feel like that. This is why this series is so good. It makes us feel so much. It makes us emote and reflect and relate to what we see. And there are not many series or many movies that are able to do that, because we're so engulfed with media, with stories, and a lot of it is forgettable. There's so many stories where, like, yeah, that's a good popcorn movie. I had a good time. And then you ask me a week later, what was the movie about? Yeah, something with dinosaurs. I don't know about the rest. With Neon Genesis Evangelion, I mean, I can tell you for hours which moments struck me and what made me think and what I discovered. And there's not a single day that I'm not thinking about the meaning of Neon Genesis Evangelion. And it's not just because I make stuff for TikTok. It's just because this story is so good and I want to rewatch it. And, you know, well, that's why I'm doing this show. That's why I'm sharing that with you, knowing very well that not everyone will be as passionate about this series. But I know that there are enough of you that appreciate this. And maybe even years later, some of you may listen to this years after I've recorded this and still hopefully get some value out of it. But now, a warning.
Proceed with the countdown.
4, 3, 2, 1.
Boom! Spoiler alert.
All right. This is your final spoiler warning. From now on, I'm going to talk in depth about what I've seen in these episodes, in this ending. So if you haven't seen the ending, please save this recording for later. Go and watch the series and then come back. For those of you that are still here, thank you. And I'm glad that you watched what I've watched. And you probably felt like I feel. Like, what did I watch? What is this about? And one of the things that I loved so much, going back to the ending of the television series, is, yeah, I could tell, knowing already in advance that this was done on a super low budget. And that is why it looks so weird. What I think is so creative and admirable is that they use what could be perceived as a huge defect of the production as an asset. It's not a bug, it's a feature. And especially when it comes to using these drawings, like at one point, a lot of the animation goes to these pencil drawings on paper, where you see just contours of Shinji. I suppose that these are just sketches that they made to prepare for animation. But they use it for a specific reason here, and that is to show how Shinji, over the course of these final two episodes in the television series, basically goes back to the drawing board. So he's stripped of everything that made his identity over time, especially what he felt should have been his identity, his relationship to his family, his father, his mother. He lost his mother. He has already lost his father, or his father abandoned him. So that doesn't give him any, you know, backbone when it comes to his own identity. He can't say, well, I'm a proud son of Gendo. Quite on the contrary. His friends, which normally kind of provide you also with a social context that defines you. And this is actually one of the things that the series says multiple times, is like, who you are is not just one monolithic ego. In fact, there are many versions of you. There is the you that you see in the mirror, but that may not exactly be the you that other people perceive. Like, your friends will see a different version of you or different sides of you, and so they will have another image of you, but it's still you. And all these different versions of you ultimately are one and the same. And so it's all about integration of you. Instead of just being stuck in the way you look at yourself, it helps and it's liberating to sometimes place yourself in the perspective of someone else who looks at you and maybe may look at you with much more mercy than, for instance, your father or you look at the way you look at yourself. And this is what Shinji has to discover by going to the bottom. He can only start rebuilding who he is if he first kind of dies to who he was or how he defined himself. There is definitely a meta theme here of death and rebirth, or death and resurrection, if you want. But so before you can be reborn as the new Shinji, if that ever happens, because of course we don't know exactly if he'll ever get to that. But anyway, there's this desire to kind of reboot, which is also, between brackets, the overall reason why they want this instrumentality project to happen, right? It's all about like a total reset. And yes, there are many different groups and individuals have different reasons why they want instrumentality, but it's all kind of comes back to the same idea, like the way we live our lives right now is broken and it hurts and it's painful and it has failed. So we need to start again. We need to go back to the source, do a reboot. And that is, of course, symbolized by this return to Lilith, this creature on the cross who is divulged to be not Adam, but in fact Lilith, the source of life. And that's interesting to me, because then you see that Lilith, this is a little bit of a thing on the side, but Lilith, of course, is not in the Bible, but it comes from, if I'm not mistaken, rabbinic tradition, where and certain like older myths where Lilith was the first wife of Adam, and Lilith turned to the dark side in a certain way and started to do horrible things, and then Eve came along, and then you had Adam and Eve, and they too messed up. But anyway, so Lilith is a bit of a strange name, and when I first saw that they had used the name Lilith, I was wondering, well, why would you do Adam and Lilith? And then you also have the Evas, you know, the human giants, they're called Evas. So you've got Adam, you've got Eve, who's Lilith? And now it makes sense. Now to have seen the ending, it's like, so they actually, Lilith is a name they used for, I would say, the divine creator. Which, interestingly, is female here. Now, we all, maybe through our iconography, if we think of the classic Christian God, we picture a man with a beard, right? Like what Michelangelo painted. Adam sitting on the left side, and then God is this older guy with lots of hair, like big beard, reaching out, touching the fingertips of Adam. And that image of God as a man, as a father, is reinforced by the way Jesus talks about God, saying, when you pray, say, our Father. But that does not say that God is male or female, because those are human categories. God is not human. He's not a creature. He's the creator. And so it's a way for us to think about who God is to us. His relationship is fatherly in a certain way. But it doesn't mean that it excludes motherly characteristics. I would say that God is just as much a mother as he is a father, because mothers and fathers, men and women, are created to God's image. And so this duality that we have in creation, where we've got males and females, the both of them still reflect something of God. And so if males reflect maybe the fatherly part of God, then mothers definitely reflect something of the motherly nature of God. And what I like is that in Neon Genesis Evangelion, Lilith is divulged to be the source of creation. She is the one that was at the origin of both the angels and the humans. They were all coming from that same source. And Lilith is, of course, a mother figure. And that is why, in the end of Evangelion, we see her identify with Rei. And Rei, of course, is a clone that ultimately stems from Shinji's mother. So Rei is in many ways a symbol of motherhood, and then that makes her very compatible with Lilith. This is why these two can merge, whereas Gendo, who thought he was the let's say the owner of Lilith and he would be in control, he's rejected. And then later on, he's even rejected by all the female characters in his life. They all judge him. They all say, you are just in it for yourself. And so there's this separation. So this whole idea of God being like a mother, the source of life, the one from who everybody is born, I think that's pretty profound. I was surprised that they used that idea of Lilith as a, you know, not as the as Adam's first wife, but you could say as mankind's first partner. God was the, in a certain way, the first partner of Adam and Eve, of mankind in general. And there's been a rift, a rupture, and it's not because of God. Just as much as Lilith here is, in a way, the victim, is sacrificed, is nailed to that cross by man. In a similar way, the Bible tells a story how man actually has tried to kill God over and over again, to eradicate him from their existence. Because God was perceived as a threat, as competition, as someone who, in one way or another, was trying to limit us. And that, of course, is kind of the original sin comes from that. It's Adam and Eve trying to be like God, equal to God, like the serpent promised that they would be if they would eat from the tree, from the forbidden tree. And not realizing that God was actually loving them as a mother, as a father, and that there, his plan was to have this eternal, you know, familial relationship with us. And in a family, there shouldn't be competition. There's not rivalry. You belong together. And that's what God hoped. But at the same time, he created us with a free will, knowing very well that that would also implicate the possibility that his creatures would reject him, which happened both with the angels and with mankind. They both, in a certain way, rejected God. Just as here, you've got Lilith as the central figure, the central source of all life, and then you've got these rivaling creatures that actually are, in a way, brothers and sisters, that they stem from the same source. But instead of loving each other, it's the Cain and Abel story. They fight each other. They see each other as rivals. They judge each other. They are afraid of one another. Which then, and this is the genius, brings us back to Neon Genesis Evangelion, the personal side of the story. This is what is repeated over and over again in every generation that followed Adam and Eve, and is ratified, in for instance, in the way that Shinji treats the people around him. Oftentimes, being afraid of them, hating them, being violent towards them. Look at what he does to Asuka at the end of the movie, of the end of Evangelion. He strangles her. He tries to kill her. He can't accept love, even when she tries to touch him and comfort him. He doesn't know what to do. He's paralyzed. And it's his failure to connect to others that makes life hell to him, and that locks him up in this incredible loneliness. And let's be honest, Asuka has the same issues. She too, because of trauma, because of her mother that didn't love her and tried to kill her and killed herself, she too, just like Shinji, is extremely hurt and traumatized. And her way of dealing with that, her coping mechanism is the opposite. It's kind of the mirror of what Shinji does. Shinji retreats into himself. He closes himself off. He fails to connect with anyone, even with himself. Asuka does the opposite. She's super aggressive. She fights everyone who gets close to her. She sees everyone as a rival, especially Shinji. And her aggression is a way for her to protect herself against others that may continue to hurt her. So she too is afraid of relationships. She too is unable to cross that chasm between her and the rest of humanity. Even friends. She can't connect with Shinji, who is clearly infatuated with her and you know, in his own clumsy way, kind of tries to show his feelings for her, but she cannot accept that at all. And she, you see these two people that are so similar, that you would say in any other story, they would have a happy ending. They're meant for each other. And yet they do the opposite. They fight each other. They try to kill each other. They hate each other. And that is the mirror of this big metaphysical problem that the entire creation is suffering from. And that is that ultimately everything that is harmful and hurtful and painful in this life goes back to this rupture of trust with this broken relationship between us and God. And then the fallout is that we too, amongst each other, are divided. The same drama happens on a spiritual level with the angels, who in at least in Christian theology are seen as pure spirits. We are a composite of both a soul, a spirit, and a body, a physical body, whereas angels are just spirit, are just, you know, the soul. But they too are free, and so you've got that same rift in the angel, in the angelic world, where some angels turned against God, refused his offer of friendship and love, which robbed them from the source of life and the source of happiness and turned them into, well, demons. What is a demon? It's someone who is devoid of God's love and who can only act out of the opposite of love and is trying to destroy love and friendship. But the thing is, and this is so interesting about Neon Genesis Evangelion, and this is also why I think it's so funny that the end of Evangelion tells the mirror story, kind of the upside down version of the way the television show ends, because this story over time reveals to us that the angels that we see as the bad guys from the start, because they are attacking us, mankind, that, well, the people who created the Evas, the people that are in charge of Salie and all these other organizations, they are just as much demonic in a certain way. They too have turned away from their mission in life, their vocation, their calling. Instead of being a source of life, a gift, a sacrifice, like Lilith is shown to be, not only is she crucified as a sacrificial victim, but then we see that her body has been severed and the lance of Longinus has pierced her, just like the real lance of Longinus in the Gospels has pierced the sides of Jesus, and water and blood came out, the symbols of the gift of Jesus, of his love, of his kindness, and his life-giving love to the world. That is symbolized in this orange liquid that streams from the body of Lilith. And so Lilith in the series is shown as a creature that lets herself be nailed to the cross and gives her life source to the world. And it's there. And we are supposed to emulate that because we are made out of we are made to resemble the Creator, and so but we don't. We want to keep everything for ourselves. We are egotistical. We'd rather destroy what we have rather than share it. And so what is interesting about Lilith is another thing that comes to mind is that in the end, at least in the end, the end of Evangelion, we see that that Lilith ultimately is not tied to the cross. She's able to step out of it. So it was like almost a free submission to the cross. It's not just because she merged with Rey that all of a sudden she's able to get off the cross. It's almost as if she wanted to be there. Interesting. Just like Jesus is not just the victim of the violence that is done to him, but he chooses to let himself be crucified. He wants to give his life for the world in order to save the world. You see, lots and lots and lots of depth in these final episodes of the television series and also in the end of Evangelion. And what we are ultimately are supposed to do, what we can do, the choices that we make, it's open. Just like Shinji can choose to reboot and tell himself, hey, I will no longer try to hide behind others or waiting for others to help me or save me. I can make new choices. I can be a new person by basically starting from scratch. I'm a blank. My life is a piece of white paper, and I can start to make my own pencil drawings of who I want to be. And then you've got the end of Evangelion, where it's the opposite, where Shinji chooses not to begin again and choose a positive future, but he turns violent. He turns destructive. He's unable to escape from that prison. In the same way, we are also, like Shinji, in front of that choice. What do we want to do with our future? Who am I? Who do I choose to be? Am I defining myself just as a failure, as someone whose life is determined by outside forces, who is constantly the victim of injustice? Or do I choose to be the one I want to be, the one I'm called to be? That requires me to make new choices, to redefine myself, to have courage, and to step away from my fear and to no longer run away from the world, not even from suffering or for myself, but to choose life. Well, that, my dear friends, was what I wanted to share with you after having seen these two different endings of the story of Shinji Ikari and his friends, and even his enemies, in a certain way. There's much more, and I've barely touched upon all the symbolism in these four episodes, you could say. But we'll get to that later when we do our rewatch. Next time, I'll do a deep dive into the symbolism in the first episode, and I will try to cover everything, but I already know it's a futile attempt because fans have been talking about the series for 27 years now. So I have no doubt that there is still a lot to say after I've tried to analyze this. But that's where I also hope to get a little bit of help from my community, from the people on TikTok, some of which are really, really well-read and experts when it comes to Neon Genesis Evangelion. But I'm also counting on you, part of my Patreon community. Let me know your thoughts. If you go on the Discord server, there's an area for anime discussion. And I would love to hear your reaction to this episode. Do you agree? Are there things that I missed? Is there another perspective? Which is totally possible, right? And in fact, I would encourage you to add your own perspective, your own interpretation. Because that's what Hideaki Anno wanted us to do. And this is what stories do. They awaken our minds, our souls, our emotions. And the more we relate to a story, the more the story actually tells something about ourselves. Who we are, who we've been, and who we want to be. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being a patron. And see you next time.